from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio, this is Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, and this week for Michael Krasny. Coming up, an 18-year legal battle over charges of environmental degradation in the Amazon. An appeals court in Ecuador recently upheld an $18 billion judgment against Chevron, the largest ever in an environmental case. An article in this week's New Yorker magazine takes us behind the scenes in this epic legal battle, a case that includes charges of judicial corruption and bribery in Ecuador, a take-no-prisoners legal approach by Chevron, and questionable ethics by the plaintiff's attorney. We'll get started with Forum right after this. Good morning and welcome to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, in this week for Michael Krasny. Well, this hour we're talking about an epic legal battle over environmental damage in Ecuador, toxic pollution in the Amazon that plaintiffs describe as a rainforest Chernobyl. It resulted from oil extracted by a consortium of companies led by Texaco between 1972 and 1990. In 1993, a group of Ecuadorians filed a lawsuit against Texaco, which fought the case until being acquired by Chevron in 2001. For the past 18 years, the case has taken many twists and turns until last year, a judge in Ecuador ruled that Chevron was liable and rendered an $18 billion judgment against Chevron. That's billion with a B. Last week, an appeals court in Ecuador upheld that judgment. But the case, as you might imagine, is far from over. And its history, including charges of corruption, questionable legal ethics, even murder, is described in this week's New Yorker magazine. The article is titled Reversal of Fortune, and joining us this hour is the author, Patrick Radden Keefe. Good to have you with us.
Thanks, Scott.
And let me just say that we will also be joined shortly by the attorneys both for Chevron and the plaintiffs. But I wanted to begin with you, Patrick. You, in your article, which is a terrific article in this week's New Yorker, you described a tour of the site in question in Ecuador, in the Amazon, Lago, is it Agrio or Agrio?
Lago Agrio, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, and you said in the piece that you spent half the day with representatives of the plaintiffs and half the day with Chevron. Describe, if you would, first of all, what you saw on that tour. What did it look like?
Well, it's actually not one site. The area in question is a kind of a large part of the Amazon in northeast Ecuador and stretches really across an area about the size of Rhode Island. In this area, there are hundreds of sludgy pits. These are kind of dark liquid pits that have been dug up in various parts of the rainforest. I say in the piece they kind of pockmark the landscape, and you come upon these. And they were dug up in the course of petroleum extraction. Interestingly, both sides agree about the existence of these pits. I mean, you go there, you see them. They're sort of undeniable. What they disagree about is the legal responsibility, who has legal responsibility for these. So I spent a day going around to some of these pits with a representative of the plaintiffs who showed me a number of places where they said that what we were looking at was environmental contamination that Chevron was clearly responsible for and should be responsible for today legally. But I also spent half the day with a representative from Chevron who showed me a variety of different places and said, look, you know, we acknowledge it's a mess here, but we don't think that we should be responsible. We think actually the national oil company in Ecuador, Petroecuador, should hold responsibility for this.
And Chevron, of course, didn't do the drilling. They acquired Texaco after the drilling stopped, right?
That's correct.
And in 1995, I believe, according to your article, Texaco more or less acknowledged that, hey, we have some culpability here and we're going to agree to clean our share of this up. Is that correct?
That's correct. I mean, it's complicated because, as I said, nobody disputes that there are these pits throughout the area. And in fact, nobody really disputes that it was Texaco that dug these pits. So Texaco was in a consortium. It was in a partnership during the years when it was drilling in Ecuador. And its stake in that partnership was only about 40%, a little bit less than 40%. So when this agreement happened in 1995, after it had left the country to clean up, it basically said, look, we'll clean up approximately 40% of these pits because that's what we should be legally responsible for. The catch is that Texaco was the operator in this consortium. So even though it only had a 40% stake, sort of financial stake, equity stake in the partnership, it was the one that actually went in and did the extraction and dug the pits. So factually speaking, it is responsible. Texaco was responsible in that it dug the pits. The question is, legally speaking, was it enough for it to remediate 40% of those pits, but not anymore?
And you said that both Chevron and the plaintiffs acknowledge that the pits are there. I mean, it's kind of hard to deny they are. You see them. Is there disagreement about what's in them, or what effects, what health effects or environmental effects there have been from the existence of those pits?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. What, you know, I said that nobody denies the existence of the pits. That's about the only thing that both sides agree on. From there, you know, there are endless aspects of this that they disagree on. They disagree on the composition of the pits, the extent to which, you know, if you have this kind of toxic wastewater, to what extent it's just in the pits or to what extent it's seeped into the groundwater. They disagree about how toxic that wastewater is. They disagree about whether or not the wastewater has created adverse health effects. I say in the piece, you know, the plaintiffs at one point commissioned a study saying that there are unusually high rates of cancer in this area. And Chevron had a study of its own which actually said, no, there aren't unusually high rates of cancer. In fact, the cancer rates are lower in this area than elsewhere in the country. So on you know, any scientific or kind of empirical question you can think of, these two sides tend to disagree.
And coming back to the origins of the lawsuit, it was filed, I believe, in 1993 as a class action lawsuit against Texaco in New York City, on behalf of a group of indigenous Ecuadorians. Is that right?
That's right. Yes. I mean, they weren't all indigenous. Some of them were indigenous plaintiffs. Others were people who had moved to the area in the years after oil was discovered.
And so we just heard that an appeals court in Ecuador upheld the judgment. How did it get from New York to Ecuador?
Right. So, well, that's one of the interesting wrinkles of this story. In the 90s, when the case was first filed, the perception on the part of the plaintiffs was that Ecuador was quite a corrupt country, and that historically it had been very dominated in recent decades by the role of the oil industry. The government often got 40% of its revenue each year from the oil industry. And so the perception was that they were never going to get a fair trial in Ecuador. Also, for a variety of reasons, the kind of legal framework made it difficult for them to bring a class action lawsuit in Ecuador at that time. So what they did was they sued in New York instead. And for the first 8 years of the case, from 93 to 2001, this was this fight between these Ecuadorian plaintiffs in a New York court with Texaco. And during this whole time, Texaco was saying, you know, you really shouldn't be trying this case here in New York. It should be tried in Ecuador. And the plaintiffs were saying, no, Ecuador is too corrupt. And Texaco was saying, no, Ecuador is not corrupt at all. They compared it kind of favorably to European court systems and said we should go down there. And in 2001, Texaco actually won. A judge in New York threw the case out. It had been up and appealed, and it was eventually thrown out of the United States. And it was decided that Ecuador would be a more appropriate forum for this case to be tried. 2003, the same group of plaintiffs brings the case in Ecuador. But since then, and increasingly in recent years, Chevron has been saying, well, Ecuador is really corrupt. We're not going to get a fair trial in Ecuador. And that's Chevron's position right now. And it's perfectly flipped, because now you have the plaintiffs, who originally were saying Ecuador is too corrupt for a case, saying, well, look, you know, the system may not be perfect, but it's good enough, and it's good enough to secure a just verdict.
And why the change in perception as to how the system in Ecuador is slanted? I mean, Texaco was saying, or rather the plaintiffs were originally saying it's slanted against them. Now Chevron is saying it's slanted against them. So what changed?
Well, one big thing that changed was that Ecuador elected a president in 2006 who is a fairly left-leaning economist, Rafael Correa, who has said that he is sympathetic with the plaintiff's position. So what the plaintiffs will tell you is that part of what's changed is that now there is a new president, there's a way of operating in Ecuador that is independent of the oil industry. So they're now in a position to get a fair trial in a way that they couldn't before. That's how they explain their change in position. What Chevron says is that, in fact, the judicial system and the rule of law in Ecuador have deteriorated in recent years, and that particularly since Correa came into power, in fact, there's more corruption, more political interference in the judicial process.
All right. And we're going to let Chevron and the plaintiffs speak for themselves in a moment. But if you would, Patrick, tell us where things stand as we sit here this morning.
Well, it's interesting. This case sort of unfolds in multiple different places at any given moment in time. So where things stand is that there's this $18 billion judgment against Chevron, which has now been upheld by an appeals court in Ecuador. The catch is that the plaintiffs, you know, could start collecting in theory on this judgment, but Chevron doesn't have any assets in Ecuador. So if the plaintiffs ever want to start collecting on this judgment, they're going to have to go to other places around the world and say, hey, there was this judgment in Ecuador. You need to respect it. And then, in theory, they can try and repossess Chevron's assets. There's a final level of appeal, though there's some dispute, and I hope we can talk about this with the lawyers, as to whether or not Chevron is going to be in a position to bring that appeal, whether it might have to post a big bond, even a multi-billion dollar bond, to do a kind of final appeal of this ruling.
And that would be the appeal with the Ecuadorian Supreme Court?
That's right.
Yeah.
Chevron is also trying to kind of undo the judgment or kind of indemnify itself through an arbitration process in The Hague. So that's another area where this is playing out, is in the Netherlands.
Wow.
And then in the third kind of major ring in the circus, Chevron, right about the time that the $18 billion judgment came down, actually sued the lead lawyer for the plaintiffs, an American named Stephen Donziger, in New York federal court, accusing him of fraud and extortion and saying that he was actually part of a racketeering conspiracy. And that case has been suspended for the moment, but may continue.
And I definitely want to come back to that, because that's a fascinating wrinkle in all of this, where the attorney for the plaintiffs actually gets deposed by attorneys for Chevron. But let's bring in the other attorneys now, or the two attorneys that are with us this morning. Ted Boutrous is a partner in Gibson, Dunn and Crutcher. He represents Chevron in the Ecuador case, and he joins us this morning from Los Angeles. Ted Boutrous, good morning to you.
Good morning, Scott.
And also here, Craig Smizer. He's representing the Ecuadorian plaintiffs in the Chevron suit. He joins us as well. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Scott.
Ted Boutrous, let me begin with you. And from Chevron's point of view, you've just been listening to Patrick Keefe describe the article and his take on the issues here. How does Chevron see it? What is the fundamental issue as far as your client sees this?
The fundamental issue, Scott, is that the plaintiff's lawyers, led by Mr. Donziger, have basically perpetrated a fraud on the Ecuadorian courts. They have exploited corrupt and politicized judiciary just in Ecuador to get what we think is a completely fraudulent judgment. Eight U.S. courts have made findings that the judgment in Ecuador and the proceedings in Ecuador are tainted by fraud. And on the corruption point you were asking Mr. O'Keefe about, Mr. Donziger is on tape in 2006, and outtakes we were able to obtain from the movie Crude about the whole case, where this is a quote from him. He says, "All the judges here are corrupt. It's their birthright to be corrupt." Mr. Donziger and his consultants and his cohorts came up with a strategy to try to pressure, intimidate the courts in Ecuador to produce a judgment that's completely fraudulent. And now the plaintiff's lawyers and their team are going to try to enforce that judgment, which is piling fraud on fraud. So that's our position. Eight U.S. courts have found that there are fraud tainting to this case. And the judgment that came out of Ecuador and the appeals judgment are the product of fraud, politicization, and we don't think it will be able to be enforced in any country in the world that recognizes the rule of law.
And that is the legal tack Chevron has taken, I think, since 2009 or 10, when that documentary, those outtakes, were obtained by Chevron. But before that, Chevron has said basically that while these environmental problems exist, we're not responsible for it. Because why?
Texaco, which was acquired by Chevron in 2003, Texaco had remediated, had cleaned up, and pursuant to agreements with the government of Ecuador, spent $40 million. Ecuador signed off on it, met all the standards. It's now been a decade since Texaco, which Chevron never did business in Ecuador at all, but since Texaco left Ecuador, the government-owned entity has been operating, and it's responsible, and in fact, to its credit, announced that it was going to clean up the environmental issues there, and to the tune of $70 million, which puts in perspective how insane this judgment is that has come out for $18 billion. They say it will cost $70 million to clean up everything in Ecuador.
But it's not cleaned up, right? I mean, they spent the money, but it's not cleaned up.
They have now announced they are going to now clean up the remaining areas that are their responsibility.
Who's they?
The government of Ecuador and Petroecuador. So they've made that announcement just in the last couple of weeks, and we commend them for that and encourage it. And, Scott, this is really a situation where the lawyers are trying to exploit something, a weak system in Ecuador. It's the lawyers, the plaintiff's lawyers, who are the ones who are exploiting a situation and trying to dupe the people of Ecuador. Mr. Donziger, we have him on tape, on video. You don't have to take it from me, saying we need to make the courts feel that their careers, the judges' careers, will be destroyed if they rule for Chevron. We need to make them think they'll be killed if they vote for Chevron. It was a campaign to pressure and intimidate. We have evidence that they ghost wrote the judgment that was affirmed on appeal, that they wrote the judgment secretly, gave it to the judge, and that's the judgment that's come out. We also, and this is now undisputed, Mr. Donziger admitted it in his deposition, that they ghost wrote the expert report that was supposed to be the neutral court-appointed expert report for the court that claimed damages of $27 billion. Mr. Donziger and his team met with the expert, wrote the report for the expert, basically pressured the judge to appoint the expert, and then tried to pass that off as the court's neutral expert report. It's the most blatant fraud in the court and most blatant fraud I've ever seen.
All right, let me bring Craig Smyser in here. And it seems, Mr. Smyser, that your colleague, Stephen Donziger, has become the focus of this, as Ted Boutrous describes it. How would you, first of all, do you feel like you need to defend him from these charges of extortion and fraud? How would you counter Chevron's take on what the fundamental issues are here?
Scott, this case is not about lawyers. This case is about 30,000 people whose lives have been devastated by a legacy of environmental pollution, which proceeded over 10 years immediately prior to the filing of the lawsuit, and for 30 years in total, in which Chevron, through Texaco, polluted the land, polluted the water, the groundwater, and destroyed the lives of the indigenous people who live there and the campesinos who came to that area after Chevron started the drilling. And I would say that the focus on Donziger and the focus on lawyers is a smokescreen, a diversion. The damage undoubtedly occurred. It still is occurring. Every day in the rainforest, it rains. When you have 900 pits filled with oil refuse and you have pipes running out of those pits and discharging that refuse, that toxic waste, into the streams of the Amazonian rainforest, that is pollution that is destroying these people's lives. This is not about lawyers.
Let me ask you about the magnitude of the judgment, $18 billion. That is a record for an environmental judgment anywhere in the world. And we heard Ted Boutrous say that the actual cleanup would cost, he said, $70 million, I believe. What is your take on what it would cost? Is it possible, first of all, to really fix the damage? What would it cost? And what's the difference between $70 million and $18 billion? Where does that money go?
Well, let me just put this in perspective. I'm sure you and your listeners recall that the United States government imposed a $20 billion penalty on British Petroleum for the Deepwater Horizon spill that occurred in the middle of the Gulf of Mexico, tens of miles away from any habitable life, without any scientific testing of environmental impact, a fine that occurred without a court proceeding, and I don't hear anyone saying, well, you know, we were denied due process. I don't hear anyone saying, well, we need to have scientific evidence to back up the environmental impacts.
But coming back to this question of the judgment, what would it take to remediate the problem, and where would the additional money go if this is ever collected on?
Well, the judgment actually awarded damages in broad categories. $5 billion of it was for remediation of the soil, There was $1 billion for health care to the indigenous people. There was a similar amount in order to provide potable water to the area. So the money is not just intended as remediation. It's intended to cure a number of the ancillary effects that have fallen from the problems that are still existing in the rainforest. And the damages occurred over, as I said, 30 years.
And of course, the lawyers would get a good chunk of that as well.
The lawyers will get a percentage depending upon what the trust that was established by the judgment feels is appropriate to pay the lawyers. And of course, Chevron has been paid, according to reports I've seen, more than Chevron has paid its lawyers more than $150 million a year to combat this judgment.
Well, then that brings up an interesting point that was raised in the article by Patrick, which is how do the plaintiffs fund this legal battle for almost two decades now? And he raises this notion of litigation financing, which is basically, I believe, hedge funds investing in your lawsuit with an eye toward getting a slice of the so-called profit of the judgment that is ultimately collected. Describe that process and why is that not suspect? It isn't really regulated, is it? There aren't any rules around that kind of financing.
It's no different than any other commercial transaction. I mean, if people want to invest in a lawsuit, they're entitled to invest in a lawsuit. I mean, that's all it amounts to. And many people.
But when you say this is all about environmental damage and the indigenous people, I mean, it sounds like some people are looking to make a buck as well.
Well, I'm sure people are trying to make a buck. Just like Gibson Dunn, my compatriot, Mr. Boutros, is trying to make a buck. I mean, why is it that people look on suspicion when indigenous people and poor people who can't hire lawyers out of their own pocket try any way they can to raise money to hire lawyers to advance their cause?
Let me just, Patrick Keefe, if I could just ask you to jump in. Do you have any other anything to add to this idea of litigation financing and the hedge fund investment?
Well, I do think it's interesting. I mean, the part of what is notable about this case is that when this thing started out, you had one of the, I mean, you know, Chevron is the third largest corporation in America. Chevron's annual revenue is a multiple of the GDP of Ecuador. The plaintiffs in this case are, you know, I think it would be safe to describe them as a historically disenfranchised people, right? They were, particularly the indigenous people, were not until fairly recently even considered real citizens of Ecuador. So they were at a pretty significant disadvantage, structural disadvantage, going into this suit. And I don't think anybody would have thought that they could last as long as they had. There are a variety of explanations for how it is that they managed to stick it out for 18 years against, you know, one and then another massive corporation and ultimately get a judgment of this magnitude. One of them is this field of litigation finance. And Stephen Donziger, the lawyer who was mentioned earlier, I mean, one of the interesting and innovative things that he did in this case was to essentially sell slugs of equity in the outcome of the case.
And Patrick, let me just have you hold that thought because we will come back. We have to take a break right here. We're coming up to the bottom of the hour. And we'll continue our conversation about this lawsuit and this case against Chevron Texaco. Give us a call if you'd like to weigh in on it, 866-733-6786. The number to call, 866-733-6786. Or you can email your comments and questions to forum@kqed.org. I'm Scott Schaefer here this morning for Michael Krasny. Much more to talk about. Stay with us. And welcome back to Forum. Scott Schaefer here this morning. In this hour, we're talking about a 18-year legal battle involving Ecuador and Chevron, formerly Texaco, before they were acquired by Chevron, over environmental damage from drilling there between 1972 and 1990. Our guests are Patrick Radden Keefe. He is a writer with The New Yorker magazine and has a comprehensive article about this in this week's magazine. Also joining us from Houston, Craig Smizer, who is an attorney representing the Ecuadorian plaintiffs. And from Los Angeles, Ted Boutros is one of the attorneys representing Chevron. And If his name sounds familiar to you, you may recognize him. He's also one of the attorneys supporting fighting the plaintiffs who are fighting Proposition 8 here in the courts in California. The number to call if you want to join us, 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Tell us what you think about this case. Should Chevron be held liable? Is the $18 billion judgment fair, or is it out of bounds? And can you get a fair trial in a place like Ecuador, if you happen to know anything about that? Let's go. Actually, before we go to the phones, Patrick Keefe, you were just saying before the break, you were talking about this somewhat unusual financing method, litigation financing, the hedge fund investment to fund the legal battle on behalf of the Ecuadorian plaintiffs. I sort of cut you off in the middle there. Do you want to?
Yeah, no, I was just going to say that I think in some ways you have to innovate if you want to keep a case like this going for this long, and if you really want to go toe to toe with a major law firm like Gibson Dunn, in order to do that, one thing the plaintiffs did was basically got investors to invest in the case by essentially saying, if we get a multi-billion-dollar judgment here, I'll sell you today a percentage slug of equity if and when we get this. So it's sort of a high risk, high reward investment. The one area where this kind of gives me pause or raises questions is just that, on the one hand, this can keep the plaintiffs in the game. On the other hand, when it does come to questions about a settlement and what a settlement number would be, it does raise questions about, well, to what extent can these investors be part of the conversation about what kind of a settlement the plaintiffs might be willing to accept, if and when it should come to that.
And just bringing us up to date again, this appeals court in Ecuador upheld the $18 billion judgment. Now Chevron is trying to stop the plaintiffs from collecting on that. And there's a federal judge in New York, Judge Kaplan, who said on Friday at the moment he's not willing to block the collection of that money. What do you think he's likely to do, and what are the considerations he's pondering?
Scott, can I jump in? This is Ted.
Yes, go ahead, Ted.
First, I just wanted to address this point that Patrick was making about financing. The whole financing issue here shows this is not about plaintiffs or people in Ecuador. If you look at the agreements, which we were able to obtain through discovery in the United States, and there are scenarios where everyone would collect money, the financiers, the lawyers, the consultants, and at the very end, if there's anything left, maybe a person in Ecuador might get some money. The plaintiff's lawyer's own documents suggest they were thinking they might make $5 billion in attorney's fees. So this really is part of the corrupt process here. And when people fund an enterprise that's seeking to enforce a fraudulent judgment, that raises really, really troubling issues. On Judge Kaplan, Judge Kaplan said for now, we had asked him to attach basically the interest in the judgment of the defendants, in our federal racketeering action in New York. We argue that Mr. Donziger, the consultants, the individuals who have been perpetrating this fraud and trying to get this corrupt judgment from Ecuador are engaged in fraud and federal racketeering. We asked him to attach and basically freeze that interest in the judgment while we pursued our racketeering action. He said it was too early because we couldn't quantify the injury to Chevron, but left the path open for us to ask him to do that at some later point. The other thing is I think you mentioned this at the outset, is we are a long, long way from anything happening here. The plaintiff's lawyers have to find some country that would enforce this bogus judgment. If they really thought it was a legitimate judgment, they would be coming to the United States. They would be going to New York. They would be going to California. They won't come near the United States because they know this judgment is a fraud.
All right, I want to go to to our listeners, but Craig Smizer, just a quick response from you. On the face of it, this is a fraudulent judgment.
No, it's not on the face of it a fraudulent judgment. Actually, quite the contrary. Every allegation that Chevron made and has made in its, as I said, its dodge, its effort to not own up to its responsibility was examined by that court and rejected, and has been examined by other U.S. courts and rejected. You know, statistics he cites about U.S. courts are largely misleading, as was his statement about the plaintiff's award. He knows the truth, and he's just not telling you the truth about what the plaintiff's arrangement is, because they subpoenaed the plaintiff's fee contracts while at the same time refusing to release their own fee agreements. The truth is, of course, my clients, the Ecuadorian plaintiffs, will get by far the lion's share of any judgment which is rendered and paid. That's what is driving this lawsuit.
All right, let's go to the phones now, and San Francisco is our first stop. Paul is on the line. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning. I think it's disgusting that I'm able to listen to the Chevron lawyers bald-faced lie the entire time about this, and it's appalling to me personally because my family's from Ecuador. I've been paying attention to this for many, many years. The evidence is absolutely overwhelming, and when you have a David and Goliath situation where, as the other as the reporter mentioned, these people are able to fight the third largest company in the United States for 18 years and finally get a judgment that stands up with the evidence that is in front of everybody's face when they go there. What Chevron says is, of course, this can't be for real. It has to be bogus. It has to be corrupt. Whereas if they had ruled for Chevron, of course, it would have been fine. But the pressure all this time was coming from the third largest company in the United States. The pressure isn't coming from 30,000 people who are suffering from cancer and dying. Ask yourself this. If you think that there was no real evidence that Chevron was responsible, how would Donziger and the plaintiffs have been able to find people to invest in this case if they didn't think they had a very clear-cut chance of winning based on the evidence there? Well, and Chevron isn't willing to accept that, and it's disgusting.
All right. Well, thanks, Paul, for that very impassioned point. Patrick,
I didn't hear a question. But
well, let me ask you, Patrick Keefe, the investors, one of Paul's points there was that they wouldn't invest if they didn't think that the case had merit. Or do they just assess the political situation and say, yeah, we think this is a kind of a corrupt system, as Chevron suggests, and we're likely to win?
Well, I think there are two different questions here. There's the question of whether the case has a chance of succeeding, and then there's the question of its merit. I mean, I think that there are certainly I've spoken with a lot of people involved in this case on the plaintiff's side, and the sort of charges of cynicism don't really gel all that well with my encounters with some of these people. It seems that there's a great deal of passion there. Having said that, I think it's also indisputable that should they ultimately prevail and start collecting on this, a lot of people are going to get rich from this.
And a lot of people are getting rich as this case goes along as well. I mean,
well, yeah, and look, I mean, to me, that's one of the interesting aspects of this story, right? Is there's this notion of zealous advocacy in the legal profession, the idea that you sort of take your position and you do everything within the bounds of the law to fight for it. And in some ways, to me, part of what's intriguing about this story is it's a story of zealous advocacy run amok. I mean, these two sides.
On both sides.
Yes, have been at long.
Can I just make a point? This is Ted again. Since the caller made some serious accusations, that caller, Paul, who called in, is actually a paid activist for Amazon Watch, which is a paid
How
arm
do you know that?
Of Mr. Donziger and the plaintiffs. And I don't think that was a
How do you know that?
Reflection. Because I know of him. I recognize what he's saying. And so his speech was basically, it might as well have been Mr. Donziger making his speech. And he made a bunch of false claims, but that's how they've operated here. We have federal judges who have said there is fraud here. By the way, the Ecuador Appellate Court did not address the fraud issues, as Mr. Smizer has said. It said that's something for the New York courts to address, and believe me, we are going to take those issues to the New York courts. But that was a paid activist, not an independent caller.
All right, let's go back to the phones. David in San Francisco, welcome.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for the call. I have actually just the opposite point of view of Paul, and I have spent many months in Ecuador, and I have given considerable financial contributions to help indigenous people. I do not work for Exxon or Chevron or any oil company. I have no particular brief for them. But, you know, Godspeed to Mr. Boutros and Chevron in this case. These plaintiff lawyers, I'm an investor. I get approached by lawyers groups to invest in these kind of cases. And it's a perfect example of the plaintiff's lawyers trying to use the corrupt system. Sadly, it's sad that Ecuador has a corrupt system, but it does, unfortunately. And these plaintiff lawyers use this to try and line their own pockets, talk about a franchise. And I don't begrudge Mr. Danziger the right to make money, but I do begrudge them the ability to use corrupt means to do so. they, of course, play on the sympathies of well-meaning people in San Francisco. You know, well, all of us want to help in cleaning the environment, and all of us want to help the poor campesinos in Ecuador. But nobody should do it by a fraud, and nobody should do it through these hedge fund-funded tactics that are just outrageous. And by the way, you should all go to Ecuador and see the rainforest. It's absolutely beautiful. It's a tiny, 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 tiny portion that is affected by this remediation, which Mr. Boutros mentioned correctly was decades ago. It wasn't even Chevron that did it. And now the Ecuadorian petrochemical company is cleaning it up. So Mr. Danziger should really go home and do better things. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, David, for the call. We've got an email here from Eugenie, looks like, who writes, didn't Chevron want this matter switched to Ecuador a decade ago? They've gotten what they asked for. Shame on them. The Orient area did not have to be left so polluted by Texaco. There were techniques available that could have been used to limit the pollution in that area. Now Chevron has to own up. It is about time. Ted Boutros, you know, one of the arguments I think that Texaco and perhaps Chevron has made is that that Texaco did what it was required to do by the standards of Ecuadorian law back in the days when the oil was drilled. Is that good enough? I mean, is it good enough to say that we lived up to the standards of a third world country that aren't as good as ours when at the same time Chevron is running ads saying, you know, what a good corporate neighbor they are all over the world?
Well, I think at the time the remediation was done, it wasn't simply looking at Ecuadorian standards. It was also, like, for example, water samples and the like met the World Health Organization standards, the EPA standards. The consultants, the remediators were world-class remediators, and the company did what it thought and what Ecuador thought was necessary. You're right. Companies like Chevron do have strong corporate social responsibility programs, and those have been enhanced over the years. And so this isn't a situation where we're saying, oh, you know, it shouldn't be cleaned up. It should be cleaned up. The way to solve these problems, it's really a broader question, broader issue, Scott, than just the legal context. It's how companies operate and how to deal with issues that come up. Litigation like this, brought by people like Mr. Danziger and pursued in this manner, is completely counterproductive. And I think
why is it completely counterproductive?
Because
if it's drawing attention to the issue.
Well, let me give you an example. We heard Mr. Smizer talk about the remediation efforts. I have had access to basically, you know, all of the files of the lawyers and the financiers. There's no discussion of remediation. It's all about the money. Once the plaintiff's lawyers started throwing out these made-up numbers, which they made them up, if they had a great case, why did they have to commit fraud? Why did they have to ghostwrite the report? The $18 billion number completely mucks up any possibility of really a serious discussion about how to clean things up and fix things and help the people. So I think I call it international ambulance chasing. What are these U.S. lawyers doing going around to these countries to exploit weak legal systems? It's also a bit paternalistic and condescending to suggest it's got to be Steve Danziger instead of Ecuador itself resolving these issues.
Well, what about the point that Craig Smizer made earlier, that the judgment against BP with the oil spill in the Gulf was $20 billion done before comprehensive independent studies? So, I mean, the size of it isn't necessarily out of scale, is it?
Well, you know, BP, that wasn't a government fine or a judgment. That was some arrangement they made. It's a completely different situation. And as I said, the government of Ecuador has announced $70 million to remediate what's there now, which has happened over the last 2 decades and after a decade after the first remediation by Texaco was completed. But you know, kind of the larger point, I don't want to argue, and I think Patrick mentioned this at the outset, there are issues there in Ecuador. The government is seeking to clean it up. The plaintiff's lawsuit isn't helping with that. It's really helping these lawyers to try to get billions of dollars in legal fees. And look, I represent companies. I defend companies. But I recognize there are important issues when there's development. And the environment is something that needs to be protected around this world. So I'm not saying that we shouldn't look for solutions here, but this case is not the way to do it. It's become an international financial enterprise for people from Texas, New York, England, offshore. That's not the way to resolve this. That's not the way to help the people of Ecuador.
And Patrick, yeah. Keefe, didn't Texaco walk away from, I think it was $140 million settlement several years ago?
It did. I mean, it's interesting. You know, we're
Mr. Boutros just suggested that the sort of $18 billion figure is on its face, you know, kind of out of proportion with the damage done. The interesting footnote on the $18 billion judgment is that, in fact, it was an $8 billion judgment, or a $9 billion judgment, excuse me, more or less, last February against Chevron, with this kind of funny caveat, which basically said, unless Chevron doesn't apologize in the next 2 weeks, this is what the judge in Lago Agrio said, and Chevron didn't, at which point the damage doubled, basically the damages doubled to $18 billion.
Let me just get a quick comment from Ted Boutros on that. That was a $9 billion.
Scott, can I respond here?
Sure,
for a second?
Craig Smyser, go ahead.
I'm sorry, but Mr. Boutros's point about the remediation needs to be put into context. Chevron had hired two auditors, independent, nationally recognized, internationally recognized audit, environmental audit firms, and Fugro McClellan gave them a report that said the total remediation costs in 1992 would be over $6.8 billion. So, Chevron, when it attempted to get discharged of its remediation obligation by a $40 million remediation, which was no remediation at all, they poured dirt over these pits. They're still there. And if you read Patrick's article, you saw about what the remediation was. You heard what the remediation was. It was inadequate, even under the auditors hired by Chevron to look at the problem down there.
Ted Boutros?
I will say also, having just been down there and seen some of these remediated sites, there are certainly areas where it seems to be less than comprehensive. I mean, there's a site that both sides told me about and the plaintiffs took me to where Chevron remediated a pit. But then about 20 yards away, there's actually a really kind of filthy, oily, kind of mucky area, just 20 yards away from the remediated area. And neither side denies that that's there. The plaintiff showed it to me, but the Chevron representative actually said, yeah, that's there. But he said, but look, that's not in our pit. That's 20 yards away. That's a completely separate area. We have no responsibility for that. So I can see how, in some instances, suggestions that the remediation has been entirely comprehensive in the areas that Texaco assumed responsibility for in the Orient are called into question.
All right. Let's go back to the phones. Gregory in Woodside, welcome.
Good morning. I just want to find out how much the hedge fund has supported the Ecuadorian people during this lawsuit. You know, how much they said it was going to take $1 billion to bring in potable water to care for the people, and how much during this lawsuit have they actually spent to support them? And then, two, what percent of this $18 billion does it measure up to how much Texaco made from the region? So is it 1% of their total revenue, or is it?
Yeah, okay. You know, Patrick, is that something you can respond to, the part about the hedge fund?
It's been, in terms of the hedge fund making separate and independent gifts to the, or charitable donations to the people in the region, I don't believe they have, but nor has Gibson done.
Yeah. And Craig Smyser, I don't know, maybe you can you say what percentage of that $18 billion, how does that compare with Chevron's profits from Ecuador? I know that it's four times the gross national product of Ecuador, isn't it?
Yes. And my understanding is that the publicly announced first quarter profits of Chevron alone exceed the amount of the judgment.
But not from Ecuador.
Scott, no, not from Ecuador. No,
Scott,
no,
the
no.
Amount
not
from
Chevron
Ecuador,
now
the
has
amount
no
from
operations in Ecuador. They do have operations elsewhere in South America, and you might recall that we recently heard about an oil spill off the shore of Brazil that Chevron initially tried to cover up and deny it even happened. And now the Brazilian government, the prosecutor, has sued Chevron for that spill off the coast for $10 billion.
Ted Boutros, you tried to jump in there.
Yes, thank you. Let me just put two things in perspective. Texaco's total revenues and profits from Ecuador was something like $500 million. So $18 billion bears no relationship to that. Petroecuador has made tens of billions of dollars before and after Texaco left. It has been operating there all these years. As to the remediation costs, Mr. Smyser made a slight mistake in terms of his suggestion about the audits. It wasn't 8 and 13 billion that the auditors estimated. They said 8 and 13 million, and Texaco spent 40 million. But that just shows the way the facts are tossed around fast and loose. And Scott, you asked me, I think we're about to ask me about this penalty. That the apology penalty, the punitive damage award, that wasn't something the plaintiffs publicly had even asked for. They, as I mentioned, they ghost wrote this judgment and put that in there. That's not something that's ever happened in Ecuador. They don't even allow punitive damages. But the judge just tacked on, or the opinion tacks on this penalty, which is unheard of. And so I think it just really further illustrates this is a lawless situation, a lawless system. In 2004, the president had dissolved the Supreme Court. So that's when things really began to deteriorate. The State Department of the United States has said in Ecuador there's a problem with judges being bribed and doing things for political reasons and other reasons. It's really a mess. It's not the way our system should function, and it's not the way to solve any of these problems.
866-733-6786, the number to call if you want to weigh in on this. 866-733-6786. And I should say, in the way of full disclosure, that KQED does get funding from Chevron, among many other organizations, companies, foundations, and, of course, listeners as well, but wanted to be fully transparent about that. Let's go back to the phones now. Gary is on the line in Sacramento.
Good morning.
Good morning. Hi.
I just wanted to point out that if the size of a judgment in the plaintiff's favor had been small enough that it didn't leave the oil companies squealing and whining like they are today, then what would be the motivation for them not to do it again? And I'm thinking the size of this judgment probably has every company in the world bending over backwards not to be the next case.
Yeah. Craig Smizer, I think, is it fair to say that Chevron and other companies, international companies, are very concerned about the precedent of a lawsuit from indigenous people and the ability to collect judgments not just in the country of operation where the lawsuit was, but globally for their global operations?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And as Mr. Boutros is the head of Gibson Dunn Department, which advertises itself as the go-to firm if your company has had an international judgment against it that's seeking enforcement, and they have defended various companies, not just in oil environmental disputes, but in toxic chemical disputes where workers claim to have been injured using chemicals in foreign countries that were benefiting United States companies. Obviously, this is a problem because in Ecuador, for instance, they used drilling practices which would not have been allowed in the United States. I mean, they had 30 base camps where they discharged the human refuse from these camps into the streams of Ecuador. I mean, can you imagine in Rhode Island, think for a second what would happen in the United States if in an area the size of Rhode Island there were 30 camps where people were discharging their sanitary waste into the streams of Rhode Island. I mean, the outcry would be extraordinary. And that's of course, why companies don't want to have the ability to have judgments rendered against them in based on their actions in Nigeria or based on their actions in India or some other place, that they claim they can act in a way that is not consistent with the way they would be forced to act in the United States.
All right, Gary, thanks for the call. Email here from Margie in Sacramento who writes, B of A stupidly bought Countrywide and now has to pay billions for Countrywide's mess. Chevron thought they had a banana republic sewed up and bought Texaco's mess. Chevron found that they made a stupid purchase after all, now has to pay up. And then a question from Bradley in Alameda. The question I have is, would both parties agree to put the settlement funds into escrow in such a way as to have them distributed as per the directives of an independent international custodian executor appointed by a body like the International Court? Rather than putting that question to them, we're getting short on time. But Patrick, Keith, let me just ask you, what are the chances of a settlement here? This is obviously Chevron is going to appeal or potentially could appeal to the Supreme Court in Ecuador, but they may not go that route, I imagine.
I think that the case will settle ultimately. I don't know whether it will happen sooner or later, but
you know, if we get to a point where the plaintiffs are basically taking their judgment and going to countries around the world where Chevron has assets, trying to get that judgment enforced, and Chevron is chasing around after them to each of these jurisdictions and saying, no, no, you shouldn't enforce it. It was a corrupt judgment procured by fraud. And so they're relitigating this thing in countries around the world. I actually think that's an outcome that neither side wants. So there have been settlement discussions quietly over the years. In fact, I learned recently there was a very recent conversation that I believe Mr. Boutros was a party to just this fall. I think that eventually it will probably come to that. What the terms of that settlement will look like, it's hard to say, but it seems to me eventually, despite all the rancor on both sides, that's probably how this is most likely to end.
Craig Smizer, would your group welcome that?
Obviously, we would welcome a payment that acknowledges Chevron's culpability and that accomplishes what the indigenous and other people in the area need to be done for the environment. Let me tangentially address
just quickly because we're short on time here.
Tangentially address an earlier comment. Actually, the people of Ecuador have complete control over whether this case is settled or not. I have nothing to do with that. They have organized themselves into committees. Those committees have an executive committee. It meets, and they tell us, they give us directions with respect to settlement and the major decisions in the case. The funders have nothing to do with that.
All right, I'm afraid that's going to have to be the final word this hour. Craig Smizer, representing the Ecuadorian plaintiffs in the case, thanks to you. Thanks also to Ted Boutros from Gibson, Dunn and Crutcher, representing Chevron, and also Patrick Radden Keefe. His article is in The New Yorker this week. He's also, by the way, writing a book about the topic, I believe, as well. So thanks to you for joining us. Forum is produced by Kevin Guillory, Judy Campbell, and Amy Machado. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. And our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Scott Schaefer, sitting in for Michael Krasny. Thanks so much for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Ferro, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.